think this is a familiar parable to all of us. He tells the parable, and the ones before it, which we didn't read, the ones about the lost sheep and the lost coin, for a reason. I think he's trying to explain to his audience what he's doing, what his work is all about, why he's doing what he does. I think he expresses the same thing in Luke chapter 19 in verse 10. He says, I came to seek and save the lost. This was at Zacchaeus' house when Zacchaeus is having lunch with him, and he indeed repents of all the things that he's done. And so what we see here is Jesus sort of preempting what ends up happening in Zacchaeus' life, but he's trying to explain himself. This is what his ministry is all about. I like to think of the parable of the lost son as a kind of microcosm of the whole Bible, because it really is God seeking humanity who's gone away from him. There are some elements here that perhaps don't exactly fit that, but I think it's significant enough that Jesus tells the story with that in mind. I want to look today at maybe in a little different way this morning. Rather than follow the whole narrative of the story, I'd like for us to think about the three characters in the story. Now, we know that each of the characters represents somebody or something else. The prodigal son, probably lost humanity. Us, me, each individual, each of us. The father, we believe, represents God, as Jesus tells the story. And the older brother, more than likely, the Jewish religious leaders of his day. Or maybe could be more than that. Could be anybody who expresses resentment over God's mercy, which seems a little bit hard to fathom. But in fact, that sometimes is what happens. So I'd like to think about what we can learn about the individuals. And I want to just kind of expand a little bit on what I see possibly going on in their lives, maybe a little bit about who it seems they probably were, some of the characteristics of what their lives were all about, and maybe just learn a little bit from those particular things. We'll start with the son. Most of your translations, most of the Bibles have a heading here, and they call it the parable of the prodigal son. I don't know if most of us know what prodigal means. It doesn't mean lost. It means wasteful. Really, that's the word prodigal. That's what it means. And if you look at what Jesus says about him, it kind of fits. He wasted all of his property. We usually call it the parable of the lost son, and I think that's legitimate as well. He was, in fact, lost and dead before he came back, and those are sort of interesting words. What can we think, what can we infer or deduce about his life in general? Who was he? Number one, his family background seemed to be a pretty good one. It wasn't like he grew up in, you know, a bad family situation. It doesn't seem that the issues are why he left were things like abuse, mistreatment, or bad parenting in general. If those, in fact, were issues, they're not told to us here. Maybe they don't matter, at least for this particular story. They are sometimes contemporary reasons we give for bad behavior. Not necessarily wrong for us to do that, but we can't impose it on the story here because we really don't know. We don't know about them. We don't know what his situation was in terms of those things. Now, they can be relevant in a person's life today, you know, but we can't use them to excuse bad behavior. And I think that's why perhaps those issues are not raised in this story. And if you think about it, Adam, who had only one parent, he still sinned. Can we blame it on bad parenting? That'd be a stretch, to say the least. He was directly parented by God. There's got to be something else at work here. And that's the problem that the Bible is trying to point out. There is this thing called sin, which we don't need to go into great detail, other than the fact is he did it. He committed. He was influenced by it. We're only told here that he went away to a far country. We're also told that he squandered his inheritance in reckless living. And that's not even clearly defined, but we all know what it is. We all can only imagine what kind of things he got involved in. I kind of wonder what his motivation was here, personally. What was he thinking about when he left? And you might be able to think about some contemporary reasons why people do the things like this that they do. Was he longing for freedom? just wanting to get away from what maybe he thought was the oppressive rule of his family situation. In other words, he had to do certain things. He was responsible in the family for certain things. Maybe he wanted to get away from that. Was he trying to find himself? And I put that in quotes. You know, that's sort of a current reason. I got to find myself. Whatever that means, it usually means I just want to go off and do what I want to do. That's more often than not, I think, people using that excuse will say something like that. Was he trying to make his own way in the world? That's not necessarily bad. Maybe he didn't like the family business and he wanted to find out what he could do. Or was there some other motivation? It appears that once he gets out, whatever his motivation was, suddenly it's, I just want to live a life of freedom and reckless living. I want to do all these other things. Whatever it was, whatever his motivation was at first, he gave in to some very destructive impulses. And that's the problem with his life, isn't it? He gives in to those destructive impulses. Well, what does he do at some point when he becomes aware of just what is happening to him? He doesn't come to his senses until the illusion of that life is fully unmasked. Suddenly, he sees where he is. He's in a pig pen. He's looking at the pigs. He wants to eat their food. And it's like all of a sudden he goes, this wasn't what I thought it was going to be. All of a sudden the illusion of this life that he wanted to live is gone. And he's facing reality here. And he says, no one gave him anything. He finds out the world is a cold, cruel place. And people are not just going to bend over backwards to give you anything. The lifestyle he had longed for suddenly came crashing upon him. And he says to himself, you know, he starts thinking about his father's house. He says, you know, maybe it wasn't so bad after all. You know what? At least they got food. And you know what? Even the servants have food back there. And he decides, you know what? I think maybe I should go back, but my expectations are going to be a lot less maybe than they were when I left. I'm going to go back with very humble expectations. And you know what? I'm not even going to expect my father to accept me back as a son. Just let me be a servant. And that's all I'm going to say to him. What else can he say? He threw away all of the money that his father had given him. His father's hard-earned money, he just threw it away on riotous living. Is this not the humble and contrite heart that we are told in Psalm 51, verse 17, that God will not despise? He goes back with his heart in his hands, basically, and he says, Father, here's my heart. It's just horrible. I've done all these bad things. I don't really deserve to be here. Can you just take me back? He returns really in the true spirit of repentance. Because I really haven't done anything to deserve being here, but I'd like to be here anyway. Which brings us to the father in the story. Now, I want you to see the father here, first of all, as a human being, not just as God the Father first. We know that's what he represents, but I want you to see him in his human form first, because that's the story we're being told. What is it about his life? What can we figure out? My suspicion is that he was certainly a wise steward of the resources God had given him. Even the servants had food to eat, and he took care of the servants. What you think about having servants is beyond the point for the story. He took care of them, and he was good with whatever God had given him. His wealth here is not portrayed as a great evil, but as a great attraction. The guy says, you know, my father, he took care of his servants, and, you know, they had enough to eat. Might he have been a fairly well-respected man in his community or his village? It seems likely, because he had things. He took care. He was a good steward with the resources God had given him. He doesn't try to stop his son from leaving. That's kind of interesting too, isn't it? I kind of wonder what the discussion might have been when his son said, I want my inheritance, I want to leave. As a parent, I'm pretty sure I'd be saying, well, you know, you might want to think about this. What are you going to do? Where are you going to go? How are you going to take care of yourself? I know you got money now, but what are you going to do with it? Where are you going? We don't hear any such discussion. What emotions might the father have been feeling at this point? When you have children, you feel very deeply, maybe in some ways you never realized was going to happen to you before you had children. Maybe he felt a little anger that his son left. Maybe that dovetailed into grief or sadness or fear. And how about maybe just the perpetual anxiety that my son is gone, where is he, what's happening to him? You know, as a human parent, that's probably what he felt. Well, how does he behave when the son comes back, which is the part that we love so much about the father here? When he sees the son far off, he runs to him. He doesn't wait for him to come back. I don't know if he got word from somebody that, hey, your son's on his way back. We saw him on the road. Father says, great, I'm going to go get him. I'm not going to wait for him to come in. I'm going to go get him. And it says in verse 20, the one emotion that we have here, it says he was filled with compassion. Well, that's apparent for you, isn't it? Filled with compassion. You're probably less concerned about where he's been, what he's done, and you're just so glad to have him back. That's your child. It's his son that's back. Might he felt relief? What other emotion might he be feeling at this point? I say relief, maybe the word is elation that his son has returned. He probably looks pretty ragged. I doubt his clothes are brand new. They're probably ragged. They're probably still stained with mud from the pigs. But he runs and he hugs him anyway because he's so glad to have him back. Not just as a hired hand, by the way, even though the son says, that's all I deserve. He says to his other servants, bring a ring, bring a cloak, bring shoes for him, you know, and let's go kill the fattened calf. We're going to have a big party. Interestingly enough, and we'll get to this in just a moment, he not only has the party, but he entreats the older son to come in and join the party. We're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I kind of wanted you to see that at this point here as well. The father doesn't get resentful of the older brother either. He wants him to join in as well. Which brings us to the older brother. And you know, usually when I go through this parable, I don't spend a whole lot of time on the older brother. And part of the reason I personally have not spent a whole great deal of time with him because it has such a negative impact on the story. You know, you kind of want to end with verse 24 with this happy ending, big celebration, and there's sort of the notion here that they lived happily ever after. It probably didn't happen exactly that way. We know that, you know, people still get into trouble. They still do things. And there were things they had to deal with and maybe had to work through some of the reasons why the son had left in the first place. Maybe the son was still going to struggle with some of those things. But at least at the end of verse 24, you have what appears to be a pretty happy ending to the crisis, at least. The crisis being him leaving, the crisis being the father concerned about where he was, the crisis being, is he still alive or not? So it's a happy thing at this point. But then you have this problem with the older brother. So I don't know, maybe it's just my desire to see that happy ending that I don't always deal with him, but I want you to think about him. There are some very insightful things said about him here that aren't just negative. There's the very negative thing here, and that's the problem with the particular story. Well, let's think about the older brother's life. What can we learn from the story about the older brother's life? Well, it appears to me, at least, in verse 12 of the story, that the father had already split the inheritance up. And if the inheritance was what we see in the Old Testament, the older brother got double the portion of what the younger brother got. So he was included in getting the inheritance when the younger son asked for his share, apparently. The older brother is the good son, okay? And apparently in verse 29, it seems like he was always the one who did what was expected of him. He was the good son. He was there all the time for the father. His father could depend on him being there. He would go out into the fields, whatever he had to do. The father could go to the older brother and say, I'd like you to do this today. Okay, this is what we got to do. He would go do it. His father could depend on him. I want you to note also in verse 31 here that when the father appeals to him, he says to them, son, you're always with me, and all that I have, all that is mine is yours. His status in the family has never changed from the day his younger brother left to the very day his younger brother comes back. He is still the older brother who has at his disposal everything that the father has. That hasn't changed. But his status with the father apparently is not the problem. At least in the father's mind, it's not. And despite the possible allusion to the Pharisees and the other Jewish leaders here, Jesus does not seem to assign any evil to the older brother except resentment. And unfortunately, resentment looms very large in the story. He is resentful of what his father does for the younger brother. And unfortunately, that's the part that makes this such a negative aspect of the story here. Some people suggest, and they may be right, that he says to the father, well, I've always served you. In fact, I think Wayne's translation says, I've always slaved for you. I've always done what you expected me to do. Was there some resentment in him always feeling like he had to be the obedient and good son? Perhaps. Did he only see his obedience to his father as a burden, not as a joy? He says to the father, you've never given me a young goat so that I can celebrate with my friends. I have a question for you. Knowing what you know about the father, would the father have allowed this if the older brother had asked for a goat? I think most of us would say, sure he would have. I don't know why the older brother didn't say, you know, dad, I want to have my friends over. Or I'm going to go to my friend's house and I'm going to take a young goat. We're just going to have a little party, just have some friends to get together. We're just going to have a good time. Enjoy yourself, my son, would, I'm sure, have been the father's thought. Yeah, I want you to enjoy being here. I want you to enjoy your life. I want you to have some joy in your life. I want you to enjoy the moments you have here. Don't think of all this as just drudgery. And that's not a bad lesson for all of us as members of the church, is it? You know, there's joy in Christianity. We always want to kind of be able to find those things and be thankful for those things. He did, after all, have all of the father's goods at his disposal. Verse 31 again. Everything that I have, everything that's mine is yours. Maybe he wouldn't have even had to ask the father. He could have just gone and done it. And his father would have said, yep, no problem on my part. I'm more than happy to let you do that. What did he miss? What about all of this did the older brother miss? Resentment, how does resentment play a role here? He just kind of, I don't know, maybe kind of like the story of Cain and Abel, when Abel's sacrifice is accepted, Cain's is not, he just got jealous. Jealousy and anger, they're very powerful emotions, aren't they? They build resentment in us, and when we can't get beyond them, this is what happens. We just stubbornly refuse to even move or to do what we're supposed to do. Here's the way I'd like to think this story might have ended, even though it ends still on kind of a sour note. It just ends with the father's entreaty. He says, it was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. You think the older brother came in to the party? I'd like to think that he would, but it looks like probably not. He should have. The father was trying to get him to see there was something good about celebrating his younger brother's return. That his younger brother was now going to be obedient. His younger brother was going to do what he was supposed to do. His younger brother was back and he was alive. We'll leave the story as is because we don't know if the older brother came in. But our story does end here with a summation of the joy of reconciliation. That's the emphasis, because both at the end of verse 24 and in verse 31, the father says, he was lost, but now he's found. He was dead, but now he's alive. Let's celebrate that. Jesus came to set that celebration in motion. That's what Jesus is trying to tell us. He came to set those kind of rejoicings in our hearts and to give us an opportunity to come back. For those of us who may have experienced that return a long time ago, don't forget, God once celebrated your return. For those who have not done so, we should remember God's invitation to return and celebrate stands open for you at all times. And for those of us who are seeking to remain faithful in that household of God, don't miss the joys and celebrations available to you as well during your Christian walk. You know, we tend to look at the word obedience in such a negative light and not see it as a way of opening up life for us and giving us joy. Let's think about that and try to see it in that way. Serving God can be hard at times, but there are joys to be experienced. In fact, those things may be the very things that entice others to come back to God. The joy that you feel in being obedient, the joy that you feel in serving God. See, those can be a wonderful witness to those around us that serving God is not a drudgery, but a joy. Remember not only the father's compassion, but not also his entreaty to the older brother. He's being compassionate to the older brother as well. Come to God. Find inner peace and joy in the arms of your heavenly Father. The angels in heaven will celebrate when you do so.